We have been doing a sermon series for some time now on King David, and this is the last Sunday in this sermon series, so if you're tired of David, you can say amen, because next week we're going to be doing a series that's really about, called Engage, that's talking about the need to get involved in the church, in different aspects of the church, but especially in small groups for accountability and growth in the Word of God and in prayer. So I hope you'll enjoy that series too. I've enjoyed this one. It's been fun looking at King David. We titled it King David, A Man After God's Own Heart, because that's what the Bible calls him. And in many ways, David is this great exemplary figure of the Old Testament. You know, he is a great king, the greatest king in Israel's history. He is a great warrior who saves them from the Philistines and brings them all together. He is a great poet who wrote many of the Psalms, a great worshiper, and in many ways a very admirable figure. But we also recognize some irony in this title because David is also a tremendous sinner. He does some things that are so horrific that we just kind of shake about them. They're worse than anything going on in our national politics, and that's saying something, isn't it? You know, we get dramatic, but we're not doing things quite like David. And yet, there's also a message of hope there. Because even though David falls short in so many ways and is such a great sinner, yet he is a repenter and someone who is still described as someone after God's own heart. So that lets us know there's hope, that whatever we do, God can still redeem us and bring us safely back. Today we're concluding this look at David, and we're looking at one of the, for us, a lesser-known story. But weirdly enough, this story was extremely popular in the Middle Ages. So if you go to Europe, you'll actually see stained glass windows showing this scene today that we're talking about. And you're probably going, why would they care so much about it? Well, I think as we walk through this story, you'll see that it actually applies to us today in ways that maybe you didn't see immediately. A little background on this story. We have to go all the way back to where we started in this sermon series, looking at the story of King Saul. And remember, David was not the first king over Israel. Saul was. Remember, Saul was chosen by God. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, this little insignificant tribe, chosen and anointed by the prophet Samuel to be the king. And here's a picture. We often see Saul with David, and David is there playing the harp to soothe his mind. Saul is there looking troubled and perplexed. Saul was a tall man, a handsome man from the tribe of Benjamin, the least of all the tribes, so politically he could help bring everybody in. Initially, he did a very good job of helping the nation. He saved them from the Philistines. He started to bring them together as a country. But very rapidly, his work as a king became more about himself and about his power than it was about God and the people. And so he started going in a wrong direction. And he was challenged in this by the prophet Samuel, and he really didn't respond very well. And in fact, God then said to Saul, you need to be set aside. This is no longer going to be your task to save the nation. And we talked about how difficult that was for Saul to hear that message and how hard it can be for us. If you've ever had a time in your life when you were told by God, this is no longer going to be your job, you're going to be set aside. We say a prayer about that every year at New Year's, a prayer that John Wesley wrote that said, let me be used by you or set aside by you. And we talked about how maybe it's easier to be used than to be set aside. Saul, set aside, refuses to have that happen. And he kind of revolts against God and says, no, I'm going to hang on. I'm going to do this job. It's going to be mine. I'm going to make it work, even though God's saying no. And this results in Saul having more and more problems, and he kind of cycles down into depression and delusion and paranoia and egomania, and things get bad rapidly. David, on the other hand, is chosen as the new king. He's from the tribe of Judah, but his family is unimportant. He's the eighth son, okay? I'm the sixth of seven sons, and let me tell you, when you get down to the sixth, you know, all the good jobs are already taken, right? You're just kind of around there. So he's the eighth, and when they're looking for him to be king, they go through all the other sons first because they can't believe it could possibly be David, who's unimportant and a shepherd, but David is selected. And then David quickly grows in stature, grows in what he's able to do. So he becomes this musician who plays for the king. He becomes a warrior who defeats Goliath. And his victories become so great and so many that people begin to compare him with Saul, and they say, you know, Saul has done these great things, but David has been even greater. And we know that Saul responds to this with jealousy and paranoia and then begins to plot against David. And we talked in one sermon about how David seeks to be loyal to Saul, loyal to God's anointed one, loyal to the nation, and yet he's dealing with Saul who's trying to kill him and do terrible things to him, and how hard that was. And really a great moment for David that he deals with that very, very well. So that's the situation, and they're related in other ways. You know, David has his best friend is Saul's son, Jonathan, and his wife is Saul's daughter, Michal. So he has all these relationships going on there, and there's all this difficulty. And then, of course, Saul and his son Jonathan fight the Philistines, and they die in this big battle on Mount Gilboa. And the Saul line just kind of dies there with him. David becomes the dominant one after this, and he rules from Jerusalem. And he has now reached a position of power and authority and peace and success. Okay? And now after he's achieved this, the question is, what are you going to do now that you have this position of power and authority? You know, some people do very well when they're in adverse situations. Some people do very well when things are going well. One of the challenges for us as Christians is to learn to do well in both situations. The Apostle Paul writes about that. He says, I've learned how to live in want, and I've learned how to live in abundance. Okay? Challenges in both places. Yesterday, I was in prison doing a day-long retreat with some of the men at the medium security prison. And while I was there, there's a retired Methodist minister there. And he said, you know, it's so great. He says, I love being here. He says, I see people whose lives are really being changed. He said, when I was a pastor out there in the Methodist church, I just didn't see this kind of thing happening. What do you think? And I said, well, you know, I don't think it's, sometimes you're going to see more dramatic changes, obviously, in a prison, hopefully, than we're going to see here. But as long as people are growing and changing, I think that's the real thing. Are we being obedient to God's will and letting him change and transform us? But I also said, you know, sometimes people can do really well in prison, but struggle out in the world. Some of us might do well in the world with our faith walk, but struggle in prison. You know, how do we do in different circumstances? So David here is in victory. You know, he has achieved everything. What do you do then? You know, years ago, I read Winston Churchill's one of my heroes, you know, and he wrote this after he was prime minister. He got voted out of office during World War II, you know. After that, he sat down and wrote a 6-volume history of World War II, right? And at the theme for the book is on this little quote that he wrote. It's on every starting page. And it says, in war, resolution. In defeat, defiance. In victory, magnanimity. And in peace, goodwill. I love that statement. I'll say it again. In war, resolution. So when you're fighting, you stick to it. In defeat, defiance. You don't go down just because you lose once. In victory, magnanimity. So when you win, you don't rub their faces in it. You show generosity. And in peace, goodwill. So here he's got victory. He's going to show magnanimity. And he's going to, in peacetime, he's going to show goodwill. And that's what we're going to see here in this scripture lesson. David asked, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul? Now, remember, he was loyal to them as long as they lived, but the house of Saul has been basically wiped out at this point. To whom I may show kindness, and then he says, for Jonathan's sake. Because Jonathan and he took a vow, you know, I'll watch out for your family, you watch out for mine. And we know how they watched out for one another. So he says, is there anybody left? Now, there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. Now, imagine this. If you were a servant of the house of Saul, right, and David now takes power, whose servant are you? Well, most people are going to be very careful to point out that they are now David's servant, because being a servant of the former king could put you in conflict, right? When David became king, all of Saul's servants became his. But they're reminded of this guy, and his name comes up, and he was summoned to David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, at your service. Actually, what it says is, I am your servant. I am your servant, is what it actually says in the Hebrew. So he's pointing out, I work for you now. You're my boss. Okay? And this is what it says then. Ziba the servant. This is the first time he's mentioned here. He was Saul's servant. Now he's David's servant. But he's going to become Mephibosheth's servant. And he's brought Mephibosheth to David's attention. So he's going to tell him about Mephibosheth here. I am your servant. And that's what he's going to emphasize here because he wants to stress his loyalty. The king said, is there anyone remaining of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? So I want to show kindness. I want to show magnanimity. I could have looked down on these. I could have wanted bad things to happen to Saul's house, but instead I want to show grace to them. I want to bring kindness. I want to bring people in together. Ziba said this to the king. There remains a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. And every time they mention him, they're going to mention the fact that he's crippled. In their society, that means he can't work, and he's really of no account. We know of his story elsewhere, Mephibosheth. He's Saul's grandson, Jonathan's son, dropped at 5 years of age, permanently disabled, and he's been living in seclusion. He's been staying with some people who are loyal to his father's house and living there, and he's in fear because if the king comes in, what's going to happen to him? Maybe something really bad. So that's the story here. And here's some pictures of him. Here's a picture of him with his nurse when he was a little baby. And his nurse is important because when Saul and Jonathan died on Mount Gilboa, everybody was afraid of an invasion, so the family evacuated rapidly. And the nurse took him with him, and he either dropped, or she dropped him, or she fell on him. It's a little unclear in the Hebrew. And he got his legs broken, and because they were running from fear, they didn't have time to help him or heal him, so he became permanently crippled from that. There's a picture of her fleeing with him. The king said, where is he? Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, son of Amiel, at Lodabar. Whew, that's the one I have trouble with. So Lodabar, I can say Mephibosheth, but Lodabar somehow it's hard for me to say. Anyhow, he's living with these other people who are taking care of him, right, because he can't take care of himself. So he's trusting to the kindness of others who are willing to take him in. David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, son of Amiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and did obeisance. And this is something we don't do in our society at all, but to lie down prostrate before somebody. You know, when our country became a country, we ceased the practice of bowing. Did you know that? It used to be when you'd meet a British official, you would bow, right? And show to the king. You'd kneel and you'd put your head down so that was a sign of obeisance, that the king's above you. But in America, presidents don't rule over us in that way, or at least shouldn't, right? So what do? We shake hands with everybody, right? You don't bow before anybody or put your head. But in their society, they did something even more dramatic. They would lie on the ground, you know, with their hands outstretched so that they're completely vulnerable. And it's called prostration. And if you ever, the closest thing I can think to it is what my dog does when it sees me every morning. It wants to let me know who's who in the pack. So my dog, as soon as she sees me, gets on her back and rolls over and shows me her belly. Scratch it, scratch it, scratch it, you know. But it's also her way of saying, you're in charge, I'm not. And I'm happy with that, okay? Other animals will do similar things, you know, to establish who's in charge and where are they in the pack. So this guy is really saying is saying, David, I am no threat to you at all. My family may have wrestled with you, but I'm not doing that. So he's prostrating himself. And David said, Mephibosheth, and he answered, I am your servant. Again, we get that same phrase, I am your servant. I work for you. I will do whatever you say. And we often see pictures here, you know, that since we don't do prostration, they often show him kneeling, and you see how David is going to then respond and lend comfort in just a minute. David said to him, don't be afraid, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. Because Jonathan was good to me, I'm going to show kindness to you. I'm going to give it back. I will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul. So you're going to get back the land that your family had, the land that Ziba's been in charge of, taking care of for me. And you yourself shall always eat at my table. Now, eating at a table, we put a table here so you could think about this. But, of course, in the ancient world, people were often hungry, right? And they didn't have enough. And he's been living with somebody just trusting on their kindness. If you didn't have enough food, you know, you'd often want to have more. But where would you especially want to eat? Well, the king has great food all the time, as much as you want. So he's the great place to eat, right? That's where you want to go. And so he's really saying, you can eat at my table. There's always a place for you there. You can have as much food as you want. You'll never be hungry again. So a great promise to him. And here's a couple artists showing King David comforting Mephibosheth as he stands before him. Different pictures of this. Okay. And by the way, isn't it interesting? Some of them show him as a very young man, but he has a son, so he must be a little bit older than this. Again, he did obeisance and said, "What is your servant?" Or he prostrates himself and says, "What is your servant that you should look upon a dead dog as I? I'm nobody. You know, why do you care about me at all?" Then the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson." So I've given everything to him. You're no longer going to be my servant, he's going to say. You're going to be Mephibosheth's. "You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food to eat." Now I'm going to tell you, this seems overkill. He can eat at the king's table all the time, but he also gets his food of his own. So he's got more than enough coming in and income coming in. "But your master's grandson, Mephibosheth, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So they're all going to work for him. So in a sense, Mephibosheth has gone from living in somebody's house, trusting on his gratitude forever, always, to now being suddenly very wealthy, having all the food he could eat and being produced by himself, having all these servants, having all this land, and also a place at the king's table of privilege and grace. And he just has everything. Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. We see him here, a picture of one artist showing him eating, another artist showing him eating. This is a popular theme. Okay, looks like he's having a good time there. Okay. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So they all move in there and live. And then one last, you know, there's another picture. Again, this time he's shown as a young boy. He must have been a little older than this. And then it says this, "Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he always ate at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet." And they keep emphasizing that, right? Okay, now I mentioned to you that in the Middle Ages, this was a favorite story. And you're probably hearing this and going, okay, mildly interesting. I've read lots of stories in the Bible that are better. Why was this one popular? And it was popular, there's one tapestry showing it from the Middle Ages. It was popular because they saw something in this story that spoke to them. Okay, and they saw that it was not just about those people back then, but they said, gee, you know, David in this story seems to be like Jesus in the New Testament, almost like he's a type of that, and Mephibosheth seems to be kind of like us. That is, here we are, we're dysfunctional in a lot of ways, we're not always the kind of people we should be, our families or maybe ourselves, we've been enemies of God, and yet we're afraid to come into God's presence, and yet God calls us forward, and we come in, and instead of him giving us a punishment, God gives us grace. He gives us love. He brings us home. He gives us all kinds of blessings in our lives, and he gives us a place at his table. So we receive things that we don't deserve, that really shouldn't belong to us, and yet we receive them, and our lives are changed. That grace that comes to all people. So when they showed this picture, they were saying, we're really Mephibosheth. We really get invited to the table. We really come in fear that God might punish us for what we've done wrong, but instead we experience that grace of God, right? So powerful story, that's what they connected up on. And I just want to lift up a few things for us here in this, just to think about a little more deeply. First of all is that fellowship. You know, I come from a big family. One of the things that we would have dinner together every night. I know today they say that most families, when their kids reach high school, no longer eat together. And a lot of them stop much earlier than that, with everybody eating separately or eating in front of a television or things. Our family, you know, was huge, and we always ate dinner together. There were certain traditions we always had. My father sat at this one end of the table, and our roof slanted. It was this weird framed house. And my dad, every day, would get up from the dinner table and bump his head. We just waited for it to happen. We thought that was really humorous. We would do other things during the we would say prayer, and the first thing we would all do then is grab for the bread, because there was only, my mom for some reason never put out a piece of bread for everybody, so if you grab, you got it. In fact, that's a phrase we had, he who grabs gets. And we also had one point during the dinner, I would sit between two of my brothers, and they would at one point go roller derby, and they'd rock their chairs and then smash into me, which we thought was hilarious. And my mom would always say, boys, stop that. You know, we had things we did. And one of the things that happened at our house was people wanted to come there because there were so many of us. It was entertaining. So we'd always have guests. And, you know, we'd often have a 10 or a dozen people for dinner. That was a common thing for us. A lot of fun and fellowship took place there. And I know one of the issues for a lot of people today is, you know, eating alone, eating by themselves, not fellowshipping with others. One of the beautiful things this story tells us is about fellowship and about coming together and about how the people of God are meant to kind of be in relationship with one another. It's one of the beautiful things about a church, right? We come together, we fellowship, we experience that relationship with one another. And it's kind of really nice to know that we have a place at the table, a place where we can come together. The church is one of those few places where if you show up, you're in, right? There are places where you go where if you, you know, you're on a basketball team, you're in as long as you can play okay. You get hurt, injured, or you're not very good, we don't really need you. But here, you show up, you're in, right? You have a place at the table. God invites everyone in, and we have that. And then there's this beautiful phrase, Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, and he always ate at the king's table. There's always this fellowship that we have that's available to us. And we see this connecting up with communion, right? We almost talked about celebrating communion today. I said, well, we're going to do that next week. Maybe it's good just to talk about it and lift it up in a different way. We're invited to that table to share in salvation and grace. And we receive from God's hand things that bless us and make us a part of the community. And there's one other dimension to this, you know, as we think about communion and how it ties it in. We know that the number one image at the time of Christ for the kingdom of God was the Messianic banquet, all gathering together to celebrate and have this food and fellowship together. So I love this artist's picture of this story, right? You see what's happening here? David looks a heck of a lot like Jesus in this story, right? I think clearly the artist is telling us this. But you see how it's Mephibosheth there and he's lame? So he's at the door and he can't walk in. So David or Jesus is bringing him in to the kingdom and into the fellowship and into the family. And what we're really saying here is the when we have fellowship, it's really a foretaste of what's meant to happen for us eternally in heaven, you know, that we have that place, that fellowship forever. So when we hear this story, you know, I hope when you read this again, if you ever read it again and are challenged to say Mephibosheth, that you will think about how it really tells us a type of what Jesus is like, how we have a place at the table. And I guess there's one other thing to this story that I want you to hear, that we should aim to be a little bit more like David, at least in this part of the story, where he is so gracious about bringing people in, about welcoming someone who the world would probably reject or put aside. But he gives a place to him and brings him home. A challenge for us to think about that. You know, we were trying to think of how we could kind of convey this story to you, and we knew we were getting the carpets clean. We thought, hey, why don't we put it in the round, have us look at a table during this time? And then we said, what else could we do? Talked about doing communion, and then we said, hey, why don't we just give a chance for people to do about a few minutes of fellowship here at a different time in the service than usual? So we put some food, we put some biscuits on there, and we're just going to invite you for a minute to gather around here and kind of fellowship before we sing our final song. So you're not done. You're hearing that? We're going to sing a final song yet. All right, but hey, get up. Believe me, there's a whole bunch of biscuits. I don't want to take them all home. So get up, share, fellowship, talk a little bit. Come up here, grab some grapes, grab some things. We're going to see how this works. We're experimenting here, trying something new. Give it a shot.